check on their homes, grab a few more personal items, or do anything else they didn't have time to when they were told to get out about a week and a half ago. The local sheriff's department was concerned the volatile Trinity Ridge fire might burn through the area. Since then, fire crews have successfully completed controlled burns to cut down on available fuel for the fire. But even though those homes have been saved, officials say it's still too smoky and too risky to completely lift the evacuation orders. About 1,500 people are currently fighting the Trinity Ridge fire, which has burned nearly 130,000 acres in the mountains. It's just 5% contained. For NPR News, I'm Scott Graff in Boise, Idaho.
And I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois. Blood donations decrease during the summer months, but patient need remains the same year-round. There are no substitutes for donated blood, and donation takes only 45 minutes. Blood donation, it's about life. More information is at 367-2202.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. The following program comes from the Focus Archives, which means for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. My name is Celeste Quinn. Good morning. Well, here we are, midsummer. During the months of summer, the evenings and nights are alive with the sounds of insects. That's from my backyard last night. Our guest in this portion of the program, writer, illustrator, and naturalist John Himmelman. While not an entomologist, he is a longtime and careful student of crickets and katydids. John Himmelman is the author of the new book, Cricket Radio, Tuning in the Night Singing Insects. It follows the publication a couple of years ago of a field guide titled Guide to Night Singing Insects of the Northeast. Himmelman describes the new book, Cricket Radio, as being about the why of night singing insects. Why do they sing? And here's another why question. Why can we be so taken with the sounds they make? After all, we call them songs. John Himmelman is the author and illustrator of nearly 70 books. His most recent, Cricket Radio, Tuning in the Night Insects, is published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. And you can find him online at johnhimmelman.com, H-I-M-M-E-L-M-A-N, or you can find a special website dedicated to this new book, Cricket Radio, and it is cricketradiobroadcast.com. John Himmelman, how are you?
I am well. Hi.
Hi. It is so wonderful to talk with you. This is such a wonderful book. It's charming and so informative.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. So the heat is and has been rather stifling here late in July 2011, but there's no laying low for these night-singing insects. Does the heat have an impact on their activity and the level of the sound we're hearing?
Well, the heat and the time of year does as well, but they are warm weather creatures, and they tend to call a lot more on kind of muggier nights than a chilly night, just because, you know, for biological reasons, their wings move better in the heat than they do in the cold.
Mm. So they're more comfortable in this weather than I am.
They're more comfortable than all of us.
Yeah. Well, let's go back maybe to that recording I made last night in my backyard, and maybe we could play a little bit of that again, and maybe you can tell us what you can hear from it. And I know it might be a little difficult over the phone, but we'll give it a try. What do you
sure.
say? Okay.
Sure.
So, what do you think?
Those are mallards. No, I'm kidding. I'm actually surprised. We're not hearing those yet in Connecticut. Those are the true katydids.
Uh-huh.
Those are the ones that give the katydids the name katydid, because a lot of people hear
katydid
in that call, katydid or katydidn't. call them. That staccato, scratchy call.
And they seem to be drowning out everybody else.
I believe they're considered one of the loudest calling insects in North America, which I'm sure you noticed in your backyard.
Yeah. I can hear them even when the house is closed up.
Yeah, right.
They're really, really loud.
See, to me, that is summer. That is the sound of summer when the cicadas start calling in the afternoon, and at night you hear the katydids. We are in the thick of it. We are in summer.
Yeah. Now, I have been told by Harriet Williamson, our producer, that you have some sounds on your end that you are willing to share with us. Would you like to play something now?
Sure. Yeah, I'll play one that you hear in a lot of movies and TV shows that uses a background sound for country settings, and this is the snowy tree cricket. So I'll just cue this up and see if this works. Oh, here we go. Okay, that's a taste of it.
So that's,
I know you get those out there, too.
Yeah, that's the snowy tree cricket.
Snowy tree cricket, also called the thermometer cricket because you can tell the temperature outside by counting the number of chirps in 13 seconds and then adding the number 40, and you get the temperature within a few degrees. But
and
this is the one that will be dubbed in, again, as sort of the background sound to add that sort of country sound to it.
Yeah. And the snowy tree cricket is one of the species that actually sings in choruses. Is that correct?
It does, yeah. Yep. They join in chorus, which makes for the insects, it's the males who do the calling, what they're calling for is to establish territory and to bring in females. And by joining in chorus, they're able to produce this big wall of sound that makes it easier for the females to follow that sound and find the males.
Hmm.
It's also used also to make it a little more difficult for predators, owls, and bats to home in on individual calling insects. It almost overwhelms them.
Oh, that's pretty smart.
Yeah, oh, they're geniuses.
Let's take a call now. We have a listener
sure.
waiting for us in Indiana on line 4. Hi.
Hi. A long time ago, I decided that I was going to become an entomologist and go to Purdue University, but it didn't turn out that way. But I still have my, interest in it. A couple of years ago, I come across a site on the Internet that dealt with the different kinds of cicadas, and it gave their sounds and stuff. And I remember one thing they said is that for localization, you can't beat a cicada. And I went out in my back balcony and put my ear to the test. And they would never get mated if I were one of them, that's for sure. I wonder if you could talk about, if you can, about the localization issue, how they can, distinguish that one particular fellow they want to meet from all the others that are making the same noises. Thank you.
Yeah, that's actually, the cicadas are in a different group. They're not crickets or katydids, and they actually call differently. They have a different mechanism. But I think it's similar. Females are looking for the loudest, strongest caller, which is it sort of represents virility and strength, and that's what they want to pass on to their offspring. So that they're even in a chorus, they're trying. In many choruses, it's usually the insects trying to outdo one another, and they all do it at the same time, so it sounds like a big chorus. But the females, they're in there looking for that loud one, the loudest one, the lead singer.
The lead singer, yeah.
Yeah, there are human analogies there, too. The lead singer, singer usually attracts more people.
Yeah. Now, crickets and katydids are of the order Orthoptera, and their suborder is Ensifera.
Right.
So cicadas, do they fit within the larger, within the order?
No, they're in a completely different group.
Because they also, here in my experience, they end their singing when night falls.
Exactly. Yeah, they're pretty much diurnal. And they're hemipteras, which are true bugs. They have sucking mouth parts.
Uh-huh.
Most of their life is underground where they're feeding on the roots of trees. And then they come up, and then you just hear that buzzing call.
And how, what are the characteristics of the suborder Ensifera?
Well, there is basically the Orthoptera, which means straight wing, that puts the grasshoppers and the crickets and katydids, it's encompassed in there. The difference between the grasshoppers and the katydids and crickets, one of the main things you notice are the antenna. Crickets and katydids have antenna that are much longer, often longer than the body or as long as the body, whereas grasshoppers have very short antenna. And one of the reasons, it's an adaptation because many crickets and katydids are nocturnal. And if you're bumping around in the night, it helps to have these extra sensory apparatuses to help you, feel your way around.
Yeah.
They also have different ways of calling. The crickets and katydids call by rubbing their wings together. Grasshoppers, they'll rub their femur, their leg, on their side. And cicadas, they actually have a little rattling. They have a hollow abdomen, and they vibrate, and they make that percussive sound.
Oh. There was an article in the newspaper recently that I clipped because I knew I was going to talk with you, and the lead was, it's a wee bug, but it makes a monster noise. And it was about, let me see if I have it here. It was about a water bug, a water boatman, and it's a 2-millimeter long insect, and it makes a really big noise, but chances are you don't hear it because the sound is reflected into the water. Well, that's neither here nor there, but it made me think of a couple of questions. How do such wee things make such big noises, and why do they do it?
Well, they with the crickets and with the katydids, they're making the noises by rubbing their wings together, their two outer wings, and they have a little file and scraper. When it's put together, when it's rubbed together, it makes a sound. It's like your fingernail running across the tips of a comb. It makes that little sound. And it's amplified by the wings and by the thorax, and that's what gets the sound out there. But they're making that sound again to establish territories. For similar reasons why birds sing, it's usually the male that's calling and establishing territory to attract the females.
And you say to silence one of these insects, you'd have to tie its wings behind its back.
It's in them to do it. Yeah, they are. They're compelled to do it. It's what keeps them going.
Yeah. A year or so back, there was a cricket that managed to fall into some part of the elevator here in the building, and it kept going and going and going. It was such a melancholy little sound, but at the same time, I thought he or she is still giving it what it's got.
Yeah, it's likely a he, and it's what they do. It's how they're wired. They are wired to call for as long as they can, and for as far into the season as they can keep going. They'll just keep going.
Yeah. You list four of the main categories of the signals these insects make early in the book. Maybe you would take us through them. They're on pages 6 and 7, and a couple of these have to do with reproduction, and that's calling and courtship. Those are two big ones.
Mm-hmm.
You want to walk us through each of these main categories, please?
Well, the calling is the one that we're most familiar with, and that's that loud, reaching out song that to bring in the females. Another one of the calls you mentioned is the courtship call. That's when a female finds the male. And it's almost like they're whispering to one another, although it's really the male making these calls. And you really notice that more with the crickets. It's a quieter, more intimate call. There's also a call that some of the female katydids make, and that's more of a, hey, I'm over here. you could settle down, because it's a dangerous thing for these insects to be sitting out and making a lot of noise when there's all kinds of predators out there that might be homing in on those noises. So having a female saying, all right, I'm over here, you can quiet down now. It's helpful. It helps the male get a little bit closer to the female. And I think the other one I have is the territorial call, and that's the males. They set up their stations, and they set up these invisible barriers that are really sound barriers that keep them from wandering too close to one another. You get two male crickets or katydids together, and they're likely to do a little jousting, a little fighting, and that could be dangerous for them. So instead, they set up their different territories in which to call the females.
Mm. What birds prey on them? Are there other animals that prey on them?
Oh, and any insect-eating bird will prey on them. Wasps are notorious for catching especially the meadow katydids.
Bats
at night will pick off those calling true katydids that you had recorded in your yard.
Mm-hmm.
And they know when they hear the bat sonar, they stop calling. If it's too close, they might drop to the lower leaves. Owls are another one. Anything that eats insects will eat these. They don't have much defense except their cryptic coloration and shape and the fact that many of them are most active at night when there are few predators.
Mm. So they can hear bats?
They can hear. Yeah, they have their ears on their elbows. Because and any creature that produces sound, it would behoove them to be able to hear the sound that the others are making. So they have these little ears on the tips of their elbows, which help them triangulate to have an idea of where another call is coming from, so they can move those ears around in their habitat. Sound bounces around funny in the grasses and the sedges and leaves where they live, and this sort of helps them be able to pick sound out.
And presumably they can hear us coming.
They can. I'm not sure exactly how fine-tuned those ears are. I'm not sure if they would hear my voice right now. I'm sitting right next to a katydid that was just calling a few minutes ago, and I don't know if it hears me or not. It might. It might be more tuned into higher-pitched things that evolve to either evade or, obviously species of its own kind it's going to hear.
Yeah. This is Focus. We're talking this morning with John Himmelman. He is the author most recently of Cricket Radio, Tuning in the Night, Singing Insects. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this morning with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. How did you learn to differentiate species and songs in among these insects?
Well, when I got started doing this, there wasn't much out there, and I started out by finding these sounds. I'm kind of a night owl, and I've written about other. I wrote a book on moths. I wrote a book on amphibians. Nocturnal creatures, and I'm out there. And I'm hearing these sounds, and I just was curious. All right. Making these sounds. So I would catch them, bring them in the house, and set them up for a while and get to know their call, and I'd be able to place that sound they're producing with the actual singer. Watching a call helps ingrain it in your memory. And I just did this for many years. I would just, there were scientific journals out, and there was a book on Canadian Orthoptera I used, so that was really most of it.
You note that our brains allow us to tune out or turn down sounds like insect song,
mm-hmm.
Especially when at this time of the year when it's such a wall of sound. Mm-hmm. To keep your wits about you, you've got to be able to do that. But if we're interested in taking in these sounds and learning more about crickets and katydids and appreciating them, how might we, as you put it, tune into the singers of Cricket Radio?
Well, I think one of the things that really helps open that up is trying to pick out the individual sound you're hearing amongst that whole cacophony of sound you're hearing. Pick out those individual singers, and if you can, see if you can find out who's doing it. And once you start noticing them, it's really hard to not notice them. At least that's the way it is for me. And it's just, it becomes an endless treasure hunt, because then, you know, you start becoming familiarized with what's going on in your own backyard, and then you hear something a little bit different, and your ears perk up. Wait a minute, I don't know what that is. And that just, so you go and you find out what that is. It just goes on and on. But that's, it's just, I really do see it as a treasure hunt for me, because here is a something that stimulates the hearing. You know, we're so visually oriented, but there are sounds out there that we don't really notice. And once you start, it's hard to stop.
Mm. Tell us about the adventure you had involving a Japanese burrowing cricket.
Huh. Yeah, I had traveled to research both of these books. I traveled down to Florida, rented a car, and just drove all the way up the East Coast. And I've been up and down between Maine and Florida several times trying to find these things and record them and seeing what's out there. And one of them was this Japanese burrowing cricket, which was introduced accidentally, and you find them a little further south of where I live here in Connecticut. And there was one. I finally thought I nailed it, and I was out recording it, and it sounded like it was coming from the car, the rental car. So I tore that car apart thinking somehow it got in my stuff. And I had all my junk lying out. This was like 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm in the middle of nowhere, Maryland State Forest. And it stopped. I couldn't find it. It wasn't in the car, so I put everything back in, and it starts calling again. And I finally, I concluded, it's underneath the car. I look under the car. There's nothing there. There's nothing under the car. And I'm crawling on my back under the car in the, you know, wee hours of the morning, looking. Maybe it's up in the nooks and crannies in there. It was nothing. And finally, I was about to give up, and I see this one little leaf, and it's up towards the front under the car, and I peek under, and that's what it was called. It was hiding under a leaf. This thing that I had been hunting for years was right there under a leaf, and I finally got it. It was just, it was a thrill. It was just one of those little moments of the hunt that kept it exciting.
Yeah. Now, how did you know that that was a Japanese burrowing cricket that you were hearing?
There are some places where there's a website called the Singing Insects of North America, put out by Thomas Walker. He's with the University of Florida, that has pretty much all of the calls of the insects of North America. And I was able to find it through there. And there's also a few. I was preceded by, who put this out? Lang Elliott, and I think it was Hirschberger, put out another CD with Cricket and Katydid calls just prior to me starting to work on this book. So I had some reference to work with.
Mm. Do you have it on your iPod?
I do now.
Well, how many species are there of crickets and katydids?
Well, you probably have similar to what we have here in Connecticut. There's probably like 75 to 80, pretty much split down the middle with crickets and katydids. In our region, which is more than people think.
Yeah. Are they found around the world?
Oh, sure, yeah. Probably with the exception being the Arctic Circle, but they're all over the world, filling every different kind of habitat niche. They're in deserts. I mean, they're in rainforests. They're everywhere. Under things, up in trees, underground. If there's a habitat, they will fill it.
Hmm. An entomologist told me a long time ago that without insects, we wouldn't be around. So what are these insects good for as we're concerned?
Well, for one thing, they're, certain insects pollinate plants. We wouldn't have our flora without insects pollinating. They're also food for other animals. I mean, that's, those are the two major things.
Well, let's take a call. This is a listener in Belgium, Illinois, line 4. Good morning.
Good morning. Another thing that crickets do is they eat a lot of the detritus that's sitting around in little corners of the house and stuff. They chew up little stuff, I think. Probably gets rid of it for us. But I wanted to introduce another little concept. I've missed bits and pieces of Ms. Quinn's show, and I may have missed this if you covered it, so I please bear with me. As a child, and I'm sure different times, there's some type of a relationship I learned between the number of calls for a cricket or a katydid and the temperature. And people kind of made some sort of relationship. If you so many clicks and certain length of time multiplied by something and subtract something else, bingo, you got an approximation of what the temperature is. Which goes back to what I heard you folks talk about very early, and that the hot weather seems to make them work better. And I was wondering, do I remember that right? And another thing I wanted to point out is that this is not exactly the same as what you're talking about, but the lightning bugs, which are indigenous here to the Midwest, I don't know how far east they go or west they go, but we have a lot of lightning bugs, and they get more blinky the hotter it is too. You know, like you never see lightning bugs when the temperature is below like 50 or 60 degrees. They always have to be like more like 90 degrees. And I was wondering if you had any information along those sort of things.
Yeah, and we did talk about the snowy tree cricket, and that's the one that it's also called the thermometer cricket, where you count the number of chirps in 13 seconds, and they had 40. There's all different kinds of formulas. And they do call more rapidly, more frequently when they're warm, and then as it gets colder, their call slows down. And it's funny, the illustrator for Guy Tonight Singing Insects, Mike DiGiorgio, he describes the katydid call, that that you're hearing now, when it becomes, when we start getting into the frost season, you know, late October, it's, and he describes it as, I'm still here. Mm-hmm. How about you? Because they're just barely hanging on at that point. But I think it just has to do with their calling mechanism. The cold slows it down. They're pretty much, they need the heat in order to move those wings and make those sounds.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. And maybe for this listener and for others who are just joining us, you'd give us that formula for the thermometer cricket again.
Yeah, sure. Hope I have that memorized correctly. You count the number of chirps in 13 seconds, which sounds kind of like a random number, and you add 40, and that gives you the temperature outdoors.
Yeah. And anything you can add about lightning bugs? And I think that on the East Coast they're called fireflies.
Yeah. They're doing the same thing as the crickets and katydids. Some people refer to the calling, the songs we hear, as signals. Because that's what they're doing. They're signaling. They're not singing. They're not singing, but, you know, the way that we think of singing. The fireflies are doing the same. They're blinking instead of calling in order to attract one another, in order to find one another. And certain species of fireflies can recognize the blinking pattern of like species. Or they'll try to fool another species. Some of the females will mimic the blink to get the male to come down, and she eats them. So there's something different going on there.
Wow. Well, you know, we might say, you know, we're burning daylight. We got to get on with this. These insects, they're burning up the nighttime, and they don't have a whole lot of time.
And right, and that's why you find that right around late August or so, there's just this, it's almost this desperate explosion of sound where they're putting everything they have into it to get done what they need to do before the killing frosts come, and they go to that big tree in the sky because they don't make it through the winter as adults.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about the life cycle of these insects.
They start out as eggs, like, you know, insects do, and they usually overwinter in that form, and come spring, the eggs will hatch. And they don't start singing until they're full adults. They have to go through their molts, usually around 5 molts, before they get those final wings that they use to sing with. And that's usually around early to midsummer when you start hearing that. And they call throughout the summer into early fall, and then after the first frost or two, that pretty much wipes them out. Usually by the second or third frost, they're pretty much gone. There might be a couple hanging on in these little micro climbs here and there, but that's the end of them.
Yeah. This is Focus. We're talking this morning with writer, illustrator, and naturalist John Himmelman. His latest book is Cricket Radio, Tuning in the Night Singing Insects. My name is Celeste Quinn. More after a short break.
WILL is your source for comprehensive coverage of the Republican and Democratic National Conventions. Each night of both conventions, NPR will bring you live reports and analysis on WILL AM 580. The PBS NewsHour will provide live coverage on WILL TV. Our national convention coverage begins Tuesday at 7 p.m. from the GOP National Convention in Tampa. WILL is your source for in-depth election news.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of items to remember special days with personalized huggies, keychains, cameras, and more. A complete online catalog can be found at trophytime.com. They're more than just trophies.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program. As this conversation is pre-recorded, we're not taking phone calls today. This is Focus.
We're talking this morning on Focus about night singing insects. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this morning with a phone call or by email. John, would you care to share another sound with us, another song of a cricket or a katydid?
Yeah, let's see. Oh, I love these. This is the northern mole cricket. Let me get this going here. And this is, these actually call from, oh, there we go. And what I hear is dirt, 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 which is pretty much telling you where they live, in the dirt. They live underground in burrows. And the male will come up, and he goes to the edge of that burrow, the lip, and he uses the shape, almost like those old Victrola horns to help the acoustic to help reverberate that sound for the females. Very hard to find these things because they are underground, but you hear them usually on the edges of ponds where there's wetlands.
Uh-huh.
Such a rich, rich call.
Deep voice.
What's that?
A deep voice.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, very,
very
deep.
Deep.
Very deep.
And they're pretty tough looking.
They
look kind of fierce. They look kind of big.
They're huge, and you talk about convergent evolution. They are so mole-like. They're even furry-like moles. They eat the same food as moles, like earthworms. They've got these big tunneling front legs. They're called dactyls that just digs these holes, like, really fast. And you could find them by looking on the ground. I don't know if you remember those old Bugs Bunny cartoons where with Bugs Bunny's traveling on the ground, you could just see that dirt being displaced along the top. Well, that's what they do. You could see these lines of the displaced dirt, just these networks of them, these highways of where they travel. And every once in a while, it ends in a hole where the male enters and exits. Just bizarre creatures.
Yeah, they are. They're a little. I've never seen one in person, but to see their photograph is kind of like, whoa. So what kind of advice do you have for us in terms of recording these insects and audio recordings and photographic recordings of them?
Well, recording's pretty easy. One of the biggest challenges is in recording these insects, and Mike DiGiorgio, who did the guide, the field guide, he also did a bunch of the recordings as well, is not picking up airplanes. It's amazing. You learn how busy our skies are when you try to record on a quiet night getting a particular call or some dog barking in the distance. I use a Marantz recorder. It's collected on one of those little flash cards, you know, like you have in your camera, those digital cards. There's no moving parts. There's all kinds of things. I mean, they're getting better and better with that technology now and smaller and smaller. And photography. Sometimes I'll collect them at night and just take my pictures the next morning. It's just easier. The lighting is better. But obviously you go out at night, you need a flash, and it gets a little more complicated. One of the upsides is they don't move around that much. So it's pretty easy to get a decent picture of them sitting, you know, wherever they are.
And do you use a special lens, a special camera?
I just have a Coolpix 990 that has a pretty decent macro lens.
Hmm.
Anything that could that can zoom in pretty well would work.
Yeah, you mentioned Michael DiGiorgio, and you and he worked together on the Guide to Night Singing Insects of the Northeast. Tell us about the work involved in doing that guide.
That was an eight-year project. I had, at the time when I was really getting into this, I realized there was nothing out at the time, nothing that was, you know, most of the books I was using were about 100 years old or from the 20s. And I had it in me to, I had an idea that maybe we should do a field guide or I should do a field guide. But it wasn't my illustration style. I wanted someone who did more realistic work. So I called Mike, who's a wildlife artist. He does mostly birds, but I've seen his insect drawings. And I said, so what do you think about crickets and katydids? Did you have any interest in those? He says, well, I was just out last night recording them in my yard. So I said, oh, great. So we set out, we did a lot. It was just fun being out in the field with someone else, and we tried to get every call we could possibly get in the area, and then I would travel on my own up and down the country trying to get the rest of them. But it was a fun project, and it was fun having, you know, finding new discoveries. We found all kinds of things that we didn't know were in our area, because who's looking? You know,
yeah.
Not a lot of people looking.
Yeah.
But it was a blast. It was a lot of fun to, I usually work alone, and it was fun to be able to work with a friend on something like this.
Yeah. So the guide has these lovely illustrations, and also it has a CD.
Right.
Yeah. Now
and his wife, Kate Davis, was the narrator for it. I wanted a female to be the narration, because it's usually always hear males narrating all these nature things. And her name is Kate, which is perfect for
Kate the Katydid. The field guide you describe as a how book.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Cricket Radio you describe as a why book. Why did you want to do a why book?
Well, it, you know, the guide is really how to tell what's singing. And then, you know, then there's the question, okay, that's how you identify them, but why should I even care? And that was, it was really an exploration into what do these sounds do for us? What do they do for me? For me, a lot of it was they're audio memories. They're almost like deja vus that would bring me back to my childhood. Again, that true katydid call, that shh, that makes me think of when I was a kid on summer nights when we were allowed to stay out and play later because there was no school. And that sound in the background was always there, and I was always associated that with the freedom of being out as a kid playing on a summer night. And different sounds do different things for different people. And that was one of the things that I was exploring is you know, what do these sounds do for us, and why should we be listening to them?
Mm.
And why do they call? Mm. And that one thing led to another.
How are these insects thought about around the world? How do people around the world think about the why questions?
Well, if you go to some of the Oriental countries, you know, in Asia, they keep them as pets much as people keep parakeets or songbirds in their homes because they like to hear their song. Well, you go to China and you go to Japan and they have these ornate homes for their singing crickets and their singing katydids just because they like to hear their song. In some places in China, they actually fight them like pit bulls. You put two male crickets in an arena, and you end up with one male cricket because they'll fight to the death, and they wager a lot of money on this. So they have, you know, some different sensibilities than we do here. There is some cricket fighting going on here, I'm sure, but that's a big thing. It's a big thing over there.
Yeah. What leads to a fight?
You put two males in an arena where neither one can escape the other, and what they start, you know, they do their warning calls, which is part of their, you know, one of those different call categories, and if one doesn't take heed, they go at it. They just go tearing into each other.
Yeah.
And it's a territorial thing, which is why they call, because it's not a good idea for them to come in close contact, because they can get hurt or they can get killed, so they set up these stations and call to avoid having these meetups happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you force it, you got something you can wager on.
Yeah. I don't like the idea.
No, me neither.
Yeah. When and how did you become enamored of crickets and katydids? Maybe here you'd tell us about the ant farm and the cricket farm you received as a as a kid.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I mean, I had an ant farm, and you know, I was going to be an entomologist when I was a kid. That was my big drive. And then my parents got me a cricket farm, which I had never heard of, and it came without the crickets because you can't stock the crickets in the store, so you had to order the crickets. And they came with little, and I don't quite understand this, they came with chariots to pull. And I think they were house crickets, and you were supposed to put these little plastic chariots, supposed to hook them up to the back of the cricket. And I thought, okay, I'll give it a shot, and I had my blocks. I must have been like 8 or 10, I don't know. And I set my blocks all over, and I got the crickets out, and I couldn't get those little chariots to stick on the crickets. But one thing I did enjoy was at night was just hearing that chirping. There was just something about hearing that. It was just a peaceful sound. And, you know, over time they died, but I still wanted to hear other crickets, and I would set out and discover what else was making these kind of calls out in my neighborhood. I grew up on a little dead end in Oceanside, Long Island, New York, where there was a lot of things to find. But that was really my first introduction to the singing insects.
And what inspired the title Cricket Radio?
That actually came from the editor at the time was Ann Downer. And she was relating it to a story of a boy. I think he was around 10 at the time. He's my friend's son, who would go to sleep to the sound of crickets and katydids that he and his father would bring in from around their yard. You know, and no radio, no TV. He wanted to hear these sounds in his room, and that's how he fell asleep at night, which I thought was, wow. You know, this is a little kid, you know, this is what he wants to do. And that became his little cricket radio, and, you know, and I mentioned how this is done in other parts of the world for that same reason. They enjoy hearing these sounds from outside in their house.
Yeah. Well, the title really grabbed me because I'm really fond of the sound of crickets, and then of course being in radio, I had to open it up.
Yeah.
So you keep crickets around today. How does one care for a cricket?
Oh, they're really easy. You could get these pet store little containers, you know, for little critter keepers, I think they're called, and they basically eat the plant that you find them on. So feeding them is easy. You know, a lot of them like plants in the ochre, cherry, sassafras. Everything eats sassafras. So you get a little leaf and you put it in the container with it. They love fruit. They will nibble away. If you get a little chunk of apple and you see a katydid out in the field, you can get them to crawl on that apple and it will sit there all day long and munch away. And a little spritz of water here and there, and they're all set. It really doesn't take that much. I keep them for a week or two, and then I let them go back where I found them, just because, you know, I feel better doing that.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if they know that they're being held captive.
I try to make it as nice as possible, so if they do, it's not that bad.
Yeah.
And also, if it looks kind of nice, too, like a little piece of furniture, it's like people have the fancy birdhouses, you know, why not make it something that doesn't look like a mess? But they really do very well. And it's too bad he's not singing now. I have a northern bush cricket that was just calling outside, and I brought it in. He's got a strawberry there he's eating right now. And I think he's a happy katydid.
Yeah. So katydids and crickets, they pretty much are happy with the same kinds of things.
Yeah. They're most of them eat leaves. And as that caller mentioned, they also eat detritus. They eat dead insects. Many of them eat live insects. They eat fruit, rotting fruit. I also sprinkle a little bit of dried cat food in there because that sort of mimics the, gives them their proteins that they would get from eating other insects and dead insects. So they're really easy to find and easy to take care of.
How long
presuming that they're not eaten by a bat or a bird or fight to the death with another one of their species, how long do mature night insects live?
Well, if they're coming into maturity around now, which is what they are here, I think you might be a little bit ahead of us in Illinois. And then the frosts start hitting right around November or so, mm-hmm. late October into November, and that's August, September. So they got it maybe 4 months, 3 or 4 months.
And how often do they mate and lay their eggs?
Some of them mate just throughout their season, and they'll keep laying eggs. Some of them don't, but as I mentioned earlier, it's those eggs that are overwintering.
Yeah. I think my favorite, if I had to pick a favorite chapter in Cricket Radio, it would be Give a Little Whistle. You spend some time in Cricket Radio in the book with the story of Pinocchio.
Oh, yes, Jiminy Cricket.
Yeah.
It was a different Jiminy Cricket than the one that we knew about from Disney. He was the conscience of Pinocchio, and he actually gets killed by Pinocchio, which shocked me. I think Pinocchio threw a hammer or something across the room and squashed Jiminy, which, what? Pinocchio killed Jiminy? So Jiminy Cricket comes back as a ghost and continues to haunt him, telling him to basically, buck up, be a good boy, which and he finally took his advice.
Mm.
And I thought it was interesting that a cricket is used for a conscience, because it seems like a perfect vehicle. It's something that you don't necessarily see, but you hear. It's a sound that's somewhat pleasant to our ear, and it just seemed like a perfect choice for if our conscience was symbolized by an insect. That would be the perfect one, with a little cricket.
Yeah. Have these insects figured in other stories and folklore?
Well, there's the cricket in Times Square, which is a well-known story. There are, the Native Americans, of course, had pretty much stories about anything that walked or crawled and flew. It's mostly the crickets that you tend to hear about, less the katydids for some reason, and I'm not sure why that is.
We're going to have to wrap up pretty quickly. Let me invite callers one last time here. We've got a caller here, a listener in Champaign. So let's go and take this call. This is a listener on line one in Champaign. Good morning.
Yes, you may have addressed this in the first part of the show that I didn't hear, but you've been speaking of crickets and katydids and not mentioning grasshoppers. I was just wondering why the distinction.
Well, that's a different group, different suborder. And I was more interested in the sounds of the night-singing insects, the encephora. Grasshoppers produce a call, but they do it differently, and it's more of a pitchless sound. It's like two pieces of sandpaper being rubbed together. But it's a different group, and I was more interested in the sounds that were mostly coming at night.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. So that big wall of sound I've got in the backyard at night, I think it's telling me that the backyard is pretty healthy for these insects.
Yeah. That is, you hear, I go in and I see chewed up leaves and hear a lot of bugs calling. That sounds like a healthy habitat to me.
Yeah.
That means that everything's producing the way it's supposed to.
Yeah. So they can indicate the health of a habitat.
Yeah, oh sure, and they could tell you what kind of habitat you're walking through. You hear pine tree crickets in the distance, you know that there are some pine trees out there. You hear a gray ground cricket, you know that there's kind of arid habitat ahead. You hear striped ground crickets calling, that means you're on sandy substrate. So all the different calls are telling you little clues about the habitat from which they call.
Interesting. Does anyone do an insect census for...
They just did one in Central Park, New York. I think it was 1 or 2 years ago that I had to miss, and I really wanted to go. It sounded like a blast. But not really. There's really not a lot of people out looking for these things.
Yeah.
So there's a great opportunity to discover things that are relatively new to the area.
Yeah. I think maybe the Illinois Natural History Survey, in combination with maybe some park districts, did one some time back, but it's not, they did it and that was that. They don't do it. I don't know how often they would do it.
And it's kind of fun because you can identify individual species just by the call, much in the way you could do with frogs or birds. So it's not a very difficult thing to do.
Mm. Well, I hope we've inspired some folks to get out there and appreciate these insects.
Me too.
Okay. And I think, you know what, we're going to wrap up with a little Jiminy Cricket.
Okay.
We'll give a little whistle. John, thank you so much for talking with us this morning. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. John Himmelman is the author most recently of Cricket Radio, Tuning in the Night Singing Insects. He's also co-author with Michael DiGiorgio of Guide to Night Singing Insects of the Northeast.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elm and University in the historic Trevett Mansion, across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
On tomorrow's Focus, in the 10 o'clock hour of the program, a conversation with journalist Catherine Schultz, author of Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. Then in the 11 o'clock hour, a rebroadcast, also from 2010, with journalist and writer Stephen Lyons, author of The Thousand-Year Flood, Destruction, Loss, Rescue, and Redemption Along the Mississippi. That's what you'll hear on Focus tomorrow. And a reminder, live shows return next week. Of course, we'll have Labor Day Monday, then a live show for you starting on Tuesday. Stay with us here on WILL AM 580. The Afternoon Magazine's coming up next right here on listener-supported public radio, WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. Glad to be with you. And in the next hour, of course, we'll have the latest news from NPR, the BBC, and Illinois Public Media. And among the stories we're following at this hour, Illinois Governor Pat Quinn has vetoed a gambling expansion bill. He says it doesn't have enough ethical protections. Also, a company is going to search for oil around the Indiana State University campus. We'll tell you about that. In the next hour, we'll have an in-depth report from Jeff Bossard on the community's impact of the possible closure of a prison in Dwight, Illinois. Lawsuits by prison employees have prompted the state of Illinois to hold off on the closure of such facilities at least through August, but there's really no telling what could happen later in cities like Dwight, so we'll hear what some of the residents feel from that community about the uncertainty of the future of the prison there that drives so much of that town's economy. Also, we'll have the latest from the GOP National Convention and what Illinois' delegates will finally get to do today as the convention does now get underway as Tropical Storm Isaac has prompted the GOP to, of course, reduce to just 3 days of convention activities. That's all ahead in the next hour, so stay with us. All right, let's update you now on what's happening in the commodity markets. We start with Kansas City wheat for September trading at 874. It's up one. December wheat's at 899.5, up one. Chicago wheat for September's trading at 862.25, up a quarter. December wheat at 882.75, up 1.5. September corn's trading at 794.5. That's unchanged on the day. December corn at 800, down 3/4. March corn at 800 3/4, down 3/4. May corn at 795, down 1/4. September soybeans trading at 1737 and a half, up 7 3/4. November beans at 1727, up 8 1/4. January 2013 beans at 1719, up 7 3/4. March beans at 1641 1/4, up 11. September soybean meal trading at 535, up 320. October soybean meal at 526.80, up 330. September soybean oil at 55.86, down a nickel. October soybean oil 56.08, also